We continue our study of 1 Samuel this evening, beginning in chapter 18 with verse 25, verse 26 actually. Just prior to this verse, when we entered our study the last time, you may remember that Saul had offered his oldest daughter in marriage to David. If David would go out and fight against the Philistines, which he did, but by the time that it came for him to marry her, Merib, she was given to another man by the name of Adriel, the Maholathite. And so Saul then offers another daughter that he has, whose name is Michal. And Michal actually is in love with David. But this time he indicates that he's not interested in a dowry as such, but he does want him to produce 100 foreskins of the Philistines. So David, in the prospect of marrying either one of the daughters of Saul, was very humble and questioned whether he should become a part of the royal family or not. But Saul has instructed his servants to speak to David and inform David that the king delights in him and that all the servants love him and try to encourage him to do as the king has suggested. Of course, the motivation behind what the king is doing is hopefully that David will be put to death. So Saul tries to make it appear that he really does appreciate him and wants him to be a part of his family, when in reality, the very opposite is true. This gives us added insight into the kind of a man that Saul was and helps us to appreciate the fact that he was indeed rejected of God to be their king. So tonight we continue our study then in verse 26, where he says, "When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, David rose up and went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So David gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife." First question we have is, why was David pleased to marry the girl who loved him?
That makes for a nicer arrangement.
Yes. Obviously, he is not aware of the king's real motives in sending him out on this mission. And he recognizes that this is a pretty nice thing for him to be a part of the royal family. And particularly in view of the fact that Michal indeed does love him. And so he's seen that God has blessed him to be able to do what he was told to do in order to have the privilege to become a part of the royal family. Why did David do twice what he was told to do? Do you have any idea?
Probably didn't have any money for a dowry.
Yes, he may have felt a little bit unworthy by the fact that he did not have money for a dowry. I think that his motivation was pure, and obviously his ability to be able to do this indicated the favor of God upon him. And so he went the extra mile. And David is a fellow that just doesn't want to do a job halfway. He wants to do a job very well. Again, we're getting insight into the character of David in some of these little details. At the same time, we're getting insight into the kind of a person Saul was. And there's really quite a contrast between the two of them. Did Saul give his daughter in marriage to David? Yes, he did. Was Saul defeated in his wicked plan in doing so?
Yes, he was.
He never intended that this should happen. Now, what's the meaning of before the days had expired? You read that in the last part of verse 26. What does that expression suggest to you?
It had a time limit.
Sure. Would the time limit have had anything to do with the possible danger that David might encounter in fulfilling this command? Sure, sure. It might have been easier to do it over a period of time, and when he's given a restricted period of time, that might have increased the danger that he faced. All right, verses 28 and 29, please.
And Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. Then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually.
Does Saul's fear of David intensify?
Yes.
In what way does Saul's plan backfire on him? He's in the royal family now, isn't he? That means he's getting closer to the throne. And Saul is not at all happy about the prospects of that. How did Saul know that the Lord was with David?
Yeah,
David's life is protected. Excellent. And the fact that he's able to produce more, twice as much as he was asked to do. So the same thing happened on this occasion. It's been happening throughout his life. When he goes out and fights against the enemy, he comes back with great victories, and all the people recognize this. And of course, Saul, in reality, is insanely jealous. Verse 30, please.
Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out, and David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul. So his name was highly esteemed.
All right, now when did this new war break out?
Probably after David went and got the...
Yeah, and obviously the chronology here would suggest that. And the people probably thought, man, we're not very happy about what he's already done, so let's get even with him. We're not told. It may have been the result of what he had just done in getting the 200 foreskins, but anyhow, the battle did take place. Now, as we move on into chapter 19 tonight of 1 Samuel, some people suggest that David served in the army of King Saul about 4 years before he was forced to run for his life. And much of what we're going to read in the next several chapters is going to be the story of David the fugitive, as he constantly is on the run trying to stay clear of Saul, who's intent on putting him to death. Here we're going to see the attempts that are made. Would somebody read, please, verses 1, 2, and 3.
Now Saul told Jonathan his son and all his servants to put David to death, but Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I find out anything, then I will tell you.
Had Saul threatened the life of David prior to this time? Sure, and this was the whole purpose of his military assignments that were given to David. Why should Saul ask his son and servants to kill David?
A threat to his throne.
They were in a better position to do it than anybody else. They were closer to him, and apparently he thought that they would have a better opportunity that would avail themselves of
David trusted them.
Yes, that's true. Now, what are David's chances of staying alive?
Not very good,
were it not for the fact that he had the protection of God. And ought not to look upon that lightly. That's an important lesson for us today. I sense that many people allow what's happening around them to overly disturb them and forget, rather conveniently, that our hope and our protection is in the Lord. And God has a way in His marvelous scheme of things to give protection and make provision for all of those who stand up firmly for him. Did Jonathan respond prudently?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Because of his love for David, he went to David and warned him of the danger and urged him to stay out of harm's way, to keep himself in hiding as much as possible. Was Saul aware of the attitude his son and servants had toward David?
No.
Not at this particular point. I don't think so. I think you're exactly right. Now, why did Jonathan steer his father into the field where David was hiding to carry on a conversation with him?
So David could hear.
Yeah, I think not only so that David could hear. In fact, he may not have been able to get close enough to David for David to actually pick up the conversation. But at least when the conversation had ended, it was not unusual for Jonathan to go out in the field, and many times he'd go out there and engage in archery practice, but he could have found some reason to kind of linger around when his father came back, and that would put him close enough to David. And if David heard, fine, and if he didn't hear, he'd be right there where he could give David the most up-to-date news of the danger that he was in. What promise did Jonathan make to David? So you can count on me, David. I will keep you informed the minute I hear about something. Verses 4 and 5, please.
Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause?"
All right. Was Jonathan's purpose to bring about a reconciliation between Saul and David?
Yes.
And it would have been in Saul's best interest to do so. Now, what did Jonathan tell his father about David? He's been very obedient. He's been very successful. He's a person you can count upon. He has risked his life for your benefit. He's made you look good in the eyes of the enemies that the people had faced. Now, what's the purpose of Jonathan's question to his father?
To find out how his father was thinking about David.
Yeah, he wants to persuade his father to give up this idea of trying to make sure that David is put to death. He just wants to talk him out of that, and hopefully his son is in a prime position to encourage his father, perhaps more than anybody else. Verse 6, please.
Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul vowed, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death."
All right, was Jonathan successful in changing his father's mind about David? Yes, he was, at least at this particular time. Now, what made Saul's change of mind meaningful?
The oath,
that's right. Backed it up with an oath. So, and apparently on this occasion, he was very sincere in what he had to say. It's rather interesting to observe how many people can be so very sincere on one occasion and then a short time later become the very opposite. But at least I think we need to give him the benefit of the doubt at this time.
When he made this oath, do we know if it was just Saul and Jonathan, that's all that heard the oath?
Probably. But that certainly would have been meaningful to Jonathan, who really wants to think the best about his father and can't understand why his father has turned on David. All right, the next verse, please.
Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly.
All right, did Jonathan bring David and Saul together after Saul had promised on oath that he would not kill David?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Verse 8, please.
When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter, so that they fled before him.
All right, now, I ask the question, what way is this verse regarded as a transition? And this is kind of a transition that bridges the gap between the time that there was reconciliation between Saul and David and Saul's attempt again to kill David, and the next time David's going to find himself not facing any more opportunities for reconciliation, but he's going to have to run for his life. So this verse kind of bridges the gap between what looked like was going to be a good thing, and now it's going to turn the other way. Was David effective in battling the Philistines this time?
Yes.
Once again, that's going to trigger Saul's jealousy for David to be so successful. That's really a sad thing. We've talked about this before, but jealousy can make everybody miserable. The person who's jealous and all the other people that have to live with a jealous person.
It doesn't make any sense, actually, because Saul was the king. David was working for Saul. Why should he be so jealous? I mean, actually. Because apparently David was a lot younger than Saul. So why not have a warrior to do your dirty work for you?
Yeah, which brings up the question of how do you explain the wrong behavior of people?
Okay.
And sometimes there just is no valid explanation. There are some people, you know, that just are their own worst enemies. And I think Saul is his own worst enemy in this whole situation.
Well, wasn't Saul aware of David being to be the next king at that time?
Yes, he knows that. He knows that he's been rejected. And he doesn't want to believe that. And I think he's making every effort to prove that what has been said is not going to be true.
If he can kill David, then he...
Yeah, he thinks he's gone a long way in protecting himself, but he's going to find out that that was not the case. All right, the next verses, please.
Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence so that he stuck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night.
All right, now, why are these words particularly damaging to Saul's reputation?
His word is...
That's right. He's broken the oath. He's not a man of his word. Was the music effective in dealing with Saul's evil spirit this time?
No.
No, it was not. So music is not a cure-all. We have to recognize that. What explains Saul's behavior?
Jealousy.
Yes, and it came as a result of what?
Evil spirit.
Evil spirit. Now notice the verse says, verse 9, where'd the evil spirit come from?
From the Lord.
From the Lord. Do you have any problem with that?
Yeah.
All right. Anybody have an answer to that problem? When it indicates that it's from the Lord, I think that what we need to recognize is that God would not wish this off on any person. But he allows people to bring on themselves what they ask for. And so when it says it came from the Lord, I think this is indicating God's permissive will, not his absolute will. God's absolute will is that nobody would ever behave this way, that nobody would ever break an oath. But if you're insistent upon being a liar and a jealous man and insanely jealous at that, God says, whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. And that is God respecting man's free will. And we all have free will. And so God doesn't force himself upon man. God encourages man. He's not willing that any should perish. But he does permit a lot of things to happen. And the things that he permits to happen doesn't mean that he makes them happen. He just knows that this is going to happen as a result of the circumstances that are in play at that time. In our own family devotions today, we're reading from Jeremiah, and we come to that passage in Jeremiah where there's a false prophet that is saying that even though some of the people have been carried away into Babylonian captivity, yet within 2 years they're going to be brought back. And Jeremiah says, no, that's not true. That's not true. And of course, Jeremiah is having to deal with the false prophet. And Jeremiah knows that the captivity is going to extend over a period of 70 years. And of course, others do not want to believe this. And it's very clear when you read the Old Testament scriptures about the Babylonian captivity, God is using Babylon to accomplish his will. And people have a real problem with that because Babylon is a pagan world power. Can God use a pagan world power to accomplish his own will? Well, yes, he can. God can use anything that he wants to. This speaks of the omnipotence of God. It doesn't mean that he condones Babylon and the bad use of their power and the destruction of the temple. Doesn't mean that he condones it at all. But he's going to use their own natural instincts and their own lust for more power to really end up accomplishing his own purpose. So when we talk about God doing things, we need to recognize sometimes that what the Lord does is really, in reality, what he permits, because he's going to make it work out to accomplish his ultimate purpose. Now, how was David able to escape?
Agility.
Okay. Yeah. Folks, I really believe that we do not fully appreciate the providence of God. And I believe that at this particular point, that the alertness of David and acting quickly and agility, I think that probably fits into it. But I think the bottom line is that this is a case where David is protecting his man by his man exercising good judgment and being on the alert, and therefore escaping what may have been a pretty bad throw from the king himself. We're not told about that, but at least he escaped from his life. And so it pays to be in right relationship with God. He does provide, he does protect, even today. Verses 11 through 13, please.
Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, in order to put him to death in the morning. Michael, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not say that tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death." So Michael let David down through the window, and he went out and fled and escaped. Michael took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair on his head and covered it with clothes.
Alright, was it unusual for means of escape to be given after the escape itself had been stated? The reason I ask that question is because that may sound a strange way to describe something. Usually we talk about all the events that led up to it, and then we indicate, okay, what's the final result? This is just the reverse. But this is rather common in Hebrew history. So this is not unlike what you would read in other passages of Scripture and other literature of that time, in which they give the result, and then they say, now let me back up and tell you how this result was finally achieved. Did Saul anticipate that David would leave home? That's right. Sure he did. Why would he post a guard if he wasn't worried about it?
Well, maybe he believed that he would get news, and that's why somebody would tell David to run.
Well, then that would be a concern. That's why he posted a guard there, so he would not escape. Okay. How was David able to get past the guard? Yeah, he didn't go out the usual way. And of course, the guard probably didn't think in terms of maybe escaping another way. You have to believe that this is probably in another part of the building that they were in, maybe in the back part of the house where they were, that he was let down through the window. Did Michael anticipate that the house might be searched?
Yes.
How do you know that?
Yeah,
she had a decoy there. Put a mannequin in the bed, didn't she? Made it look pretty real. So she's doing what she can. Now, why were orders given to wait till morning to put David to death?
Do they want everybody to see?
I'm sorry?
Do they want everybody like, in the area to see the execution or somewhere else?
Very well could have been, but I think also he might have been afraid that his daughter might be in danger. And if they did it at night, they might get mixed up, you know, and get the wrong person. And so if they waited until daylight, then they would be less risk in killing the daughter. Would a man just aroused from sleep be less apt to have the strength to defend himself?
Yes.
Probably. And that might be another reason for waiting until the morning. How did Michael learn of the plot against her husband?
Well, she's part of the king's household, from the servants, from...
Somebody's talking out loud, aren't they? And so she happened to be around at the right time to hear it. We're really not told the exact way in which she got the information. But again, I would account this as being a part of the providence of God. Did Michal place her own life in jeopardy in helping David to escape?
Yes.
Oh, yes, she did. Now, why did Michal go to the trouble to make it look like David was in bed since he'd already escaped? Yeah, buying time. That's exactly right. Now, what does the superscription of Psalm 59 tell us? Anybody have a Bible? This is a Bible study. I hope you do. Yeah, somebody find Psalm 59 and read the superscription. And by the way, the superscription is important. A lot of the Psalms have superscriptions. Many times they will give the information of who wrote the Psalm. They will also give instructions to the musicians as to the kind of psalm this is and the kind of tune that you're going to use to sing this with. And sometimes it will tell you the background or the event that has occurred that prompted this psalm to be written. So if you find that, read for me the superscription. That's the part that comes before verse 1 in Psalm 59.
To the chief musician at Altaschik's Mecham Tam of David, when Saul sent and they watched the house to kill Saul.
Yeah. And didn't the first part of the superscription say prayer for deliverance from
deliver
the enemies?
From my enemies, oh
yeah.
My God.
Okay. So this psalm, this ought to give you more understanding of the meaning of the psalm when you recognize that what we're studying now tonight in 1 Samuel gives you the background for understanding this particular psalm. These words that you had difficulty pronouncing are words that describe the artistic form of the psalm itself and also the kind of melody that's going to be used when the psalm is sung. You want to say something?
My Bible's got, it quotes the name of the tune.
Yeah, that's just simply defining the word. Yeah.
So people would be familiar with that music.
Yeah. Altasheth is the word, and that's the word that indicates the tune to which they're going to sing this particular psalm when they sing it. Right. All right, verses 14, 15, please.
When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me on his bed, that I may put him to death."
Did Michal tell a lie?
Yes.
Yes, she did. Were the messengers initially intimidated?
Yes.
How do you know that?
Because they went back and he sent them.
That's right. They went back to inform the king, "Hey, your son-in-law is sick." What shows the determined anger of Saul?
Bring him to me.
All right, bring him to me. And would this have been a difficult thing for them to do?
Not really.
All right, why do you say not really?
Pick him up on bed and carry him.
What kind of a bed would it have been?
A little stone bed.
I don't know.
Not the kind that you probably sleep on at night.
Yeah,
it would have been a mattress. Probably a very thin mattress. That they slept on. That's what the beds usually were in that day. So this would not have been difficult.
Before we get too far, what was the household idol doing in a Christian king's home?
The Bible doesn't tell us.
Wives, women.
Yeah.
There was a Greek word for... That was a Greek word for... Yeah. Okay.
I don't know.
Doc Smith believes it was probably a war trophy.
But that's an opinion.
Yeah, it is an opinion.
Yeah,
right.
Well, that's a possibility.
So would this be similar to something like that, like a family crest or something like that, symbol of the home? When they say idol, or maybe? I mean, I know you're saying it's just an opinion.
Maybe something's the right shape and size.
You know, I think of the articles that Rachel had, too, that she hid when her father came looking for the articles to say, why have you stolen these? And I think, what are you doing with them to begin with? I just don't know. I suppose another answer, since we're sharing opinions, would be, how many times have you gone into a Christian home and seen things that you think, what's this doing in this home?
True.
Too many times, I'm afraid. At least that's been my experience. All right, verses 16 and 17.
When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed, and a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michael, why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped? And Michael said to Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I put you to death?
Now, was what Michael told her father on this occasion true?
No.
No, it was not. She probably feels justified in saying this, but it's not true. How does Saul regard David?
Enemy.
As his enemy. Is Michael trying to justify her actions to her father?
Yes.
Yes, she certainly is. Verse 18.
David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he said, and he and Samuel went and stayed in Nail.
All right, did David ever again appear in Saul's court? No, he did not. On what previous occasion had Samuel and David met? At the time he was anointed. Time he was brought in out of the field to receive the anointment of Samuel to be the next king. Why didn't the two of them stay in Ramah? In reality, they did, but it's in a different section. Naioth is a place, well, you'll see this when you get down to verse 22, that they're a part of the same general location. It would be comparable, I think, to some of our towns today that have a suburban area that, do people ever kind of confuse Cocoa and Rockledge, or Cocoa and Cocoa Beach, and it's just another part of the same general area that we're talking about. I lost my place. Where are we?
Verse 18, 4.
Okay, number 4. And the answer is likely not. All right, verses 19 and 20.
It was told Saul, saying, behold, David it is Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to David, but when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing and presided over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied.
So what strange phenomena takes place at this time?
God's sense of humor.
That's a nice way to say it. Yeah. Here they went out to do a job, and they ended up becoming a part of the people that they were supposed to not regard as their friends. Though there is much we may not understand about what happened at this time, what obviously is very clear.
God's protecting David.
God is in control. I like the way you answered. That's certainly true. And they were unable to complete their mission in arresting David. Now, does this event remind us of anything that happened during the ministry of Jesus when he was here upon the earth?
Yeah, when they were going to push him over the cliff, and he just walked back to all the people, and they didn't even see him leave.
Yes. Does it remind you of any other event in the life of Christ? I can think of a couple others. Remember the time when the people were so opposed to him, and yet they all fell backwards? And do you remember the time that the Pharisees sent some of their officials out to get Jesus, and they came back empty-handed? And how did they explain that?
Disappeared.
Never a man spoke like this man. The power of language. So a lot of interesting times in Scripture in which we see some strange phenomena taking place. Was there a school of prophets in this location? Sure sounds like it. Samuel probably was the founder of this prophetic movement. Were the messengers carried away by the religious excitement of the prophets?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's a religious excitement. I think they were overwhelmed by the Spirit of the Lord in such a way that to rebuke their evil desires, and they therefore became one with the prophets in their prophesying. Verses 21 and 22.
When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So Saul sent messengers again, the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came as far as the large well that is in Sukkah. And he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah."
Yeah, now see here in the last part of this verse you just read, Naioth and Ramah, so that indicates that these two places are certainly in both a part of the same general area. Now how many times did Saul send messengers to get David?
Three
different times. Does that remind you of three times somebody else was on a mission and they were discouraged from fulfilling that mission? Balaam, when he was sent by Balak. Balak sent to get him to come and pronounce a curse, and three times Balaam had transportation problems.
How about the soldiers that went to get Elijah?
Yeah, that'd be another occasion. Yeah, right. Very good. Was the reception and reaction of the messengers the same each time?
Yes.
Yes, it was. What does Saul do when the messengers failed in their mission to arrest David? Sure, so let's see what happens now. Verses 23 and 24.
He proceeded there to Naioth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naioth in Ramah. He also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets?
All right, did Saul have the same kind of experience that the three groups he had previously sent had?
Yes,
he certainly did. Did the same spirit of prophecy which had originally confirmed his calling now block his way and thwart his will?
Yes.
Yes, it did. Why did he remove his clothes?
I don't know. It doesn't say.
That's true. Probably. Now, when it talks about somebody being naked, that doesn't mean that they're devoid of clothes. It's usually talking about taking off the outer garment. And he probably removed his royal robe at this time. Maybe it was a hot day, the number of reasons why people might shed their coat or their outer cloak. Why did Saul lay down? Probably because he was exhausted, having made this trip there. How are we to understand the meaning of naked? Well, I've just explained that to you. It just simply means that he removed his outer garment. What is the Spirit of God doing on this occasion? Yes, he is. Lest you find this real difficult to understand, let me just ask you a question. Have you in your lifetime ever seen anything that just amazed you and you just were beside yourself to try to figure out why did things happen the way they did? Seems to me that these kinds of experiences happen periodically from time to time in a variety of different ways. A lot of different ways are used to account for this. What is the significance of the question, is Saul also among the prophets?
Well, he sent all his messengers and now he's...
Yeah. You know, let me tell you a true story. It just happened a few weeks back. There's a lady from China that came to one of our Bible colleges in the United States to take a summer course. And she was finishing up some kind of a program. And her husband was a part of the what's the word that I want that describes the
military?
Yeah, it's the part of the government that is very atheistic and is not going to tolerate the church or anything like that. Well, her husband came to be with her toward the last, and also to examine what kind of education she was getting here, and as a result of coming to see what she was learning, he became really interested in Christianity. And so he expressed that interest. He said, "Can somebody explain to me what this is all about?" And one of the men associated with this college spoke to him and ended up baptizing him into Christ. So he went back to China, a Christian, along with his wife. But he's high up in government, and obviously is a part of an atheistic group that does not tolerate Christianity. It's going to be interesting to see what might happen with his witness there. But I find it very interesting to see how circumstances sometimes will bring about transformations that you never would have dreamed of, and ways that you never would have thought of to bring about a change. How is this episode with Saul prophesying before Samuel to be reconciled with 1 Samuel 15:35, which states that Samuel never saw Saul until his death? I've asked you this question before because we've already studied 1 Samuel 15, and here we are in 1 Samuel 19. And, of course, the answer to that is the same. They did not meet because that was their intended purpose. They just happened to be in the same place. But Saul did not come to see Samuel. He came to get David to make sure that he was going to be put to death, and it didn't work out that way. So it's not a contradiction. It's just a way in which you understand what is being said and why it's being expressed that particular way. Now, David has been protected thus far, but he is very much aware of the fact that his life is still in danger, and he's going to have one last visit with Jonathan, and he realizes now that he's going to have to really keep his distance away from Saul if he's going to stay alive. So we read about a wonderful experience of covenant relationship between David and Jonathan in this passage. Would you read verse 1 of chapter 20, please?
And David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?"
Now, what was Saul doing when David was fled from Naioth?
Prophesying.
Yes.
Coming around prophesying.
And he came there looking for David. He ended up prophesying and lay down all night. But probably while he was sleeping that night, he decided, "I better get out of here while getting out's possible for his own safety." Now, why did David come to Jonathan if he was trying to escape from Saul? I'm sorry? Yeah, here's a case of where a friend in need is a friend indeed, and David needed help. And actually, David doesn't want to run away. He really doesn't. And he's very sincere, you know, when he says, "What have I done wrong?"
Jonathan helped him before.
Yes, he had. Yes, he had. And, of course, Jonathan is his real best means of getting through to Saul and finding out what is really behind Saul's behavior. Why is all this going on? Did David know how long it would be before Saul would continue pursuing him?
No.
What is David doing by asking these rhetorical questions? Why does he say, "What have I done?" Why does he ask, "What's my iniquity?" Why does he ask, "Why is he seeking my life?" What are these questions saying?
He doesn't understand.
That's right, he doesn't understand. Does he claim to be sinless?
No.
No, but he doesn't think that there's anything in his behavior that justifies Saul's action.
He's sinless against Saul.
That's right. He's been really obedient. He's really been helpful. He's done everything he's been told to do. He's not committed any crime. He's not tried to undermine his kingship. And he just thinks, I just don't have the answer to this. Well, don't we reason that way sometimes today when we try to figure out why other people are treating us the way they do? He said to him, "Far be it that you should not die. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Now, does Jonathan believe his father was seeking David's life?
No.
No, he doesn't. And that's what he's saying here. He said, David, you just all mixed up here. That's not right. Now, why did Jonathan question David's concern?
Because his father always told him what he was doing.
Yes, and this is something that David had not confided. I mean, that Saul had not confided in Jonathan. And why hadn't he?
Because of a friend.
By this time he learns that there's really a close friendship between the two of them. Now, was Jonathan trying to comfort David?
Yes.
Oh, I think that he was. Verse 3, please.
Then David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight." And he said, "Do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and God."
Did the words of Jonathan convince David that he was in no danger?
No.
No, they do not.
Mr.
Yes, ma'am.
Back in the beginning of 19. Jonathan was thinking that Saul was going to put him, was looking out, or looking to get David. And then, but now you're saying the other. I'm confused.
Well, after that, Saul promises Jonathan.
So he trusts him.
I think the main answer to what you're asking is the fact that Jonathan is just thoroughly convinced that he has a good relationship with his father. And if his father really were this intent, he would have known something about it, and he doesn't know anything about it. So he thinks that David is just dreaming something up, because if you're really in that kind of danger, I certainly wouldn't know about it because of my relationship with my father. Okay. Why did David come to Jonathan if he was trying to escape from Saul? Am I asking the wrong question here?
Yeah, you're down the next.
In verse 2? Verse 3? Okay. How does David express the seriousness of the danger he is in? Yeah, that's a statement that is often quoted from. I'm sorry?
But he's saying, "But as truly as the Lord lives."
Yeah. There's just but a step between me and death. How does David explain to Jonathan that his father had not confided with him on this matter?
Because they were friends.
That's right. And that is really the explanation behind it. What oath does David take to convince Jonathan of the danger he's in from his father? Yes, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives. So David feels very strongly about this. Of course, David is right. Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." Did David convince Jonathan of the seriousness of the danger he was in?
Yes,
he does. And so Jonathan's going to agree to try to help him in any way he can. Would you read verse 5, please?
So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king, but let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening."
Okay, now what is the new moon?
It was another feast.
It was, and the scriptures speak about this, and even the New Testament scriptures, when they say that no man judge you according to the Sabbath or new moon celebration and so on. So this is a religious festival that they would have together. Often held at the place of the tabernacle, but sometimes held in people's homes, and sometimes shared with the family. And this occasion, it appears to be almost like a family reunion in celebrating this particular feast of the new moon. Verses 6 and 7, please.
"If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. If he says it is good, your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, you know that he has decided on evil.'"
Okay, so what does David tell Jonathan to say to his father if he misses David at the feast? Yeah. Yeah, and assuming that Jonathan's the one that gave him permission to say, "Hey, that's going to be okay. I know what my father likes or what he doesn't want you to do. And so he's been given this opportunity to be with the family." Now, what would Saul's response to the words of Jonathan indicate about Saul? Yeah, if he lost his temper, Jonathan would know what? That David's life indeed is in danger. So that's going to be a signal for Jonathan. Would there be anything irregular as far as the law was concerned in the fact that David wished to be with his own family at this sacrifice of feast? No. And by the way, you can use Deuteronomy 12, verse 21, as a scriptural reference for this particular feast of the new moon. Might Saul think that David should be with him rather than with his family, since he was a part of the king's court?
Yes.
Since the law states that such feasts should be kept at the tabernacle, how do we account for the feast in Bethlehem? Again, the scriptures do not say, but let me... You know, sometimes I think, and I'm guilty of this, I read the word of God with glasses that tell me this is an ideal situation. But in reality, the Bible tells us the real story. Do Christians today always behave like Christians ought to behave?
No.
Do they always attend church like they ought to attend church?
No,
they do not. Do they always observe family devotions like they ought to observe family devotions? No, they don't. So we have, I think, in the Old Testament, indications also of people not always doing the things just exactly the way that God would desire. They're doing them, but they're doing it in a different way. And so I think that the very fact that the tabernacle has gone through some problems at this time, you remember prior to this, we've seen the Ark of the Covenant being taken away, and when it was brought back, it was brought back one place, and then it was moved on over to Kiriath-Jearim, and then from that place, it was probably taken to Nob. We're not sure, but probably was there, and we'll come to Nob after a while. But this, like I indicated earlier, sometimes these feasts were observed as kind of a family reunion. And if I were looking for some way to try to explain something, I might say, have you ever known of a group from a church that decided to go on a trip as a church group? And they're going to be gone over Sunday, and sometimes they will have their own service where they are in their own group. And some people might say, well, that's not right. You should go to a local church. Well, there may not have been a local church, number one. Again, there may have been. And if there were they still wrong in having your own service? These kinds of things happen. So they raise questions, but the Bible does not give us any further information except that apparently this did not raise eyebrows too much. Verse 8, please.
Therefore deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself. For why then should you bring me to your father?
Alright, who is referred to as your servant?
David.
David is, that's right. Was the friendship between David and Jonathan a covenant relationship in the sight of God? Yes, it certainly was. Why does David use the word "if" regarding iniquity? Yeah, that he's just saying, I'm not aware of it, but if perchance there is. So he's not acknowledging that there is, but he just is making that a possibility, and if so, he needs to know about that. Why does David want Jonathan to kill him instead of Saul in the event that David is guilty of iniquity? Yeah, I really think that he thinks that Saul will act irrationally. That Jonathan would not. Jonathan would not do anything unless he thought this is really deserved, this is the right thing to do. And I think David is recognizing the character of Jonathan as being certainly supreme to that when compared with Saul. Jonathan said, far be it from you, for if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it? Is Jonathan convinced that David has done anything wrong? No, he's not. Is Jonathan shocked at the suggestion that he might deliver David over to his father?
Yes.
Yes, he is. Does Jonathan reaffirm his friendship with David?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Verse 10, please.
said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you personally?
So what now concerns David? Yeah, how am I going to know what's going on? How are we going to communicate? Does David entertain the possibility that Saul might suspicion something is going on between Jonathan and David and therefore refuse to show Jonathan, refuse to allow Jonathan to communicate with David?
Yes.
That's a very strong possibility. Verse 11.
Jonathan said to David, come and let us go out into the field. So both of them went out to the field.
Well, why would Jonathan suggest that they go out into the field? Yeah, that's a place that would not excite any curiosity. They'd be more apt to have privacy out there where they could talk with each other. Verses 12 and 13.
And Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be with me. Witness when I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day. Behold, if there is good feeling towards David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, and may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father.
Does Jonathan assure David that he will keep him informed of his father's reaction to David's absence?
Yes.
Yes. Will Jonathan keep David informed even if the news is not good news?
Yes.
That's what he says. How does Jonathan voice his approval to David that he will keep him informed whether his news is good or bad? Yes, he makes it pretty strong, doesn't he? He said, let it happen to me if I don't make this known to you. How does Jonathan wish David well?
May the Lord be with you as he was with my father.
Yes. Verses 14 and 15.
If I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth.
So what is Jonathan's request of David as he makes it known in this verse?
Not to cut off the whole house.
Yeah.
The custom was to eradicate the previous dynasties,
anybody who could come back and try to reclaim the throne.
That's exactly right. Does Jonathan realize that David will one day be king?
Yes.
Sure he does. So what bearing does Jonathan's awareness of David's future kingship have on him at this time? Well, you've already answered that question when you recognize that when a new king comes, he tries to get rid of all the previous king's family so that there's no threat against him. How did David fulfill this promise after he became king?
He took care of Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth,
that's right. We'll read about that in 2 Samuel chapter 9. All right, verses 16 and 17.
So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemy. Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he had loved his own life.
What's the meaning of the words, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies?
If you don't keep this covenant, may the Lord send somebody to kill you.
Yeah. In any way you read this, Jonathan is praying that David's enemies are going to be held accountable for what they, the way they've treated him, what they've done to him. Why did David agree to the terms of this covenant? That's right. This is a real strong friendship relationship that David and Jonathan have with each other. How strong was the love each man had for the other? How does the Bible express that?
They loved
each other as much as they loved themselves.
Yeah. By the way, is that scriptural?
Yes.
Love your neighbor as?
Yourself.
As yourself, right. Verses 18 and 19, please.
Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. For you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone Azel."
All right, did Jonathan have any doubts that David would be missed at the feast of new moon?
No.
No, he didn't. Did Jonathan consider the possibility that it might take 3 days for David to be missed?
Yes.
Is the stone Azel mentioned anywhere else in Scripture? The answer is no. Verses 20 through 22.
I will shoot arrows inside as though I shot at the target. And behold, I will send the lad, saying, "Go find the arrows." If I specifically say to the lad, "Behold, the arrows are on this side of you. Get them, then come, for there is safety for you and no harm, as the Lord lives. But if I say to the youth, 'Behold, the arrows are beyond you,' go, for the Lord has sent you away."
All right, would Jonathan arouse any suspicion by carrying his bow?
No.
No, that was his usual weapon. Did Jonathan have a code communication with David that would not be detected by anyone with him?
Yes.
Would David be in hiding near the stone Azel?
Yes.
Why did Jonathan take these precautions in communicating with David?
Because he didn't know who would be with him.
That's right. "As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever." So what was the agreement?
I protect the man.
All right, he's going to give him a sign. They know what the sign is. And Jonathan is going to protect the life of David as very best he possibly can. Now, who was the witness to this agreement?
The Lord.
The Lord was. Verses 24 and 25.
"So David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty."
What's the significance of sitting by the wall?
Nobody can come get you from behind.
That's right. And this would have been opposite the doorway into the room, and it would have been the place of honor, and probably the safest place also. Why did Jonathan stand up?
He was done eating.
I think to show respect for the entrance of the king to his father. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, "It is an accident. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean." Did Saul make any mention of David's absence the first day?
No,
he didn't. What did Saul assume was the reason for David's absence? What did he mean, he's not clean?
Not ceremonially clean.
That's right, ceremonially clean. What would make a person ceremonially unclean?
Well, he had touched a dead person, of him being a soldier.
That's right. Even walking on the grave of a dead person would be. So, you know, that entered his mind. Why did Saul repeat himself?
Because he couldn't believe he wasn't there.
Trying to convince himself.
I think that's right. I think that's what he's trying to do, convince himself. Verse 27.
"It came about the next day, the second day in the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has the son of Jesse not come to meal, either yesterday or today?'"
So how long did the new moon celebration last?
3 days.
All right, at least 2 days we know. Only 1 day was prescribed by the Mosaic law, but here we come now to the a third day. Would uncleanness be the reason for David's absence on the second day?
No.
No, because he would have had time to take care of that. Does it appear that Saul spoke casually to Jonathan about David's absence?
Yes.
Yes. What may be observed about Saul's reference to David?
Calls him Jesse's son.
Yeah, and that's not intended to be a compliment at all. Doesn't refer to him as his own son-in-law.
Is that like calling somebody by their middle name?
or their full name in the South.
Yeah, right.
Why would Saul inquire of Jonathan about David's absence? He knew clearly about their close relationship. Verses 28 and 29.
"Jonathan then answered Saul, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. For he said, please let me go, since your family has a sacrifice in the city. And my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me go away that I may see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table.
What part of Jonathan's reply may be an embellishment of David's words?
His brother.
Yeah. That's probably been added just to make it sound a little bit better. Do you ever get the impression that when you hear somebody tell a story, they've embellished it just a little bit? Did Jonathan lie?
Yes.
Embellished. He lied, but he told him what David told him.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that he lied. I think that his answer was intended to be a bit deceptive, however. Did Jonathan explain David's absence as if it was of no serious consequence? Yes, he did. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now, send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." Was Saul satisfied with Jonathan's answer regarding David's answer?
No.
Or his absence, rather. No, he was not. How may we account for Saul's anger? I think that he's really angry at his own son.
He caught Jonathan.
Yeah. I think that really is eating away at him. Now, look at these two verses in answer to this third question. What four ways did Saul make known his anger? Now, what's the first way? Yeah, that's being very slanderous of him in that kind of language. What is the second way that he makes known his anger?
Choosing David over himself.
Yeah. You are choosing the son of Jesse to the shame of your mother's nakedness. So he's talking about you're not even acknowledging your real mother as your mother here. That's what he's talking about there. He's saying you're shaming your own mother. What's the third one?
Kingdom will be established as long as this man lives.
Kingdom will be established.
Yeah. And then the final one? Yeah, Saul ordered Jonathan to send and bring David so that he could make sure that he died. Did Saul expect Jonathan to follow him to the throne?
Yes,
he did. Okay, surely did. Had Samuel previously told Saul that his kingdom would not continue?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he had. Mm-hmm. The problem was Saul did not want to believe it. All right, we've run out of time. We'll pick it up there next week. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we learn a lot tonight in observing the behavior of these individuals, David, Jonathan, and Saul. Help us to let that be a mirror for us to look firmly at ourselves. What is it that angers us? May we be honest in answering that question. Are we really as faithful to you as we ought to be? Help us to see the correct answer to that question. Do we really establish meaningful friendships? Help us to answer that question honestly. Help us to see through this all that there are many things that are not good. But even when things are not good in relationships between people, and even when things are hard to believe, may we never forget that remaining faithful to you always has its reward. We trust in your providence. We praise you for your omnipotence, for your omniscience. We thank you for your love and grace, and most of all, for your mercy. Continue to be merciful upon each one of us. Help us to apply the lessons of Scripture to our lives, that we might recognize that true safety is in the center of your will. May that describe where we are every day of our lives. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.